Game of Thrones fans, take a deep dive into your favorite epic fantasy world with audio from the largest ever convention for GOT fans. Stitcher Premium now has 16 sessions from Con of Thrones. Listen to interviews with talent from the show and expert discussions touching on topics like race, gender, and possible spinoffs. It's a must-listen for all Game of Thrones fans. Just go to stitcherpremium.com/conofthrones and use the promo code CRACKED at checkout to get your free month.
I'm noticing these changes start to occur to my surroundings, and I'm thinking, okay, what the hell did I just do? What did I sign up for? What did they give me? Is this even MDMA? And then it was just like a paradigm shift.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Cracked Gets Personal. I'm Brandon Johnson, your radio black friend. My partner is Robert Evans, who's sort of a journalist. Today, we're continuing our talk about illegal drugs. Specifically, we're talking about how a lot of currently illegal drugs might hold the solutions to some of society's greatest ills. To start explaining why drugs are good, here's Robert.
I'd like to actually pass that duty off to Dr. Carl Hart, because I'm just a guy who likes being high, and he's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia University. According to Wikipedia, he's also the first tenured African-American professor of a science at Columbia. He thinks we've got a lot of problems with how we view drugs and addiction in this country.
Pass the duty to Carl Hart.
Well, I'm Carl Hart. I'm the chair of psychology at Columbia University. I'm also a professor in psychiatry. I do research with people and drugs, so we bring people into the lab. It's actually laboratory research where we bring people into the lab and we test the effects of drugs.
Right before, actually, I called you, one of the things I watched was the interview you did with Bill O'Reilly on his show. You know, the Rat Park study has been fairly famous among some circles, but it hasn't been translated into policy. And I think what I'm interested in is why it seems to be so difficult to get people to accept a different way of looking at what addiction is, because it seems like what you're saying and what Dr. Alexander is saying is that we're kind of doing the wrong thing by focusing on the characteristics of these substances rather than focusing on the quality of life of the people who become addicted to them and like what in their life leads them to addictive behavior.
So there are multiple messages that happen in a public. So there are some people that we focus on a variety of factors in terms of that may be driving their drug use. Particularly people who are well off or people who we think are more deserving. But when it comes to undeserving people, we have this broader message that it might be something about them themselves, or recently we've shifted that message to it's in your brain. So it's not, we can say that we're not saying it's your fault, but really we are, it's in your brain. And then we have this other bigger message that these drugs are so addictive and so dangerous, we should ban them or severely restrict their use. So we have multiple messages going on. It's just that most of those messages are inconsistent with the data, and they just seem to be wasteful in terms of resources.
I want to play this clip of Dr. Carl Hart arguing with Bill O'Reilly because, well, it's just beautiful.
Let's talk about the statistics. Let's talk about the data. In 1978, the recent number of marijuana smokers in the 12th grade, it was 37% of the 12th graders said that they smoked marijuana recently. Today, that number is down to 22%.
Not the number I just gave.
Well, your number
that's
is
senior,
wrong.
That's
no, well, your number is wrong.
Take it up with the National Institutes of Health, all right?
Look,
they're the one that put it out.
I am a council member on the National Institutes of Health. Your number is wrong. I'm telling you it's 22% of seniors who smoked marijuana in the past month.
All right.
That's a fact.
I doubt it's the fact because we don't get this wrong.
No,
these researchers.
That's
but,
wrong.
All right. Well, we'll call them again and tomorrow.
Okay. Bill O'Reilly admitted at the end of that segment that he had been incorrect. I just love him citing the National Institutes of Health and then Dr. Hart saying, "Motherfucker, I'm on the National Institutes."
Yeah, that's
of
my
health.
Favorite moment yeah. ever.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful moment. I started my conversation with Dr. Hart by saying what seemed pretty obvious to me, that incarceration to deal with drug addiction doesn't work. So we need some sort of different drug policy that does work. And Dr. Hart actually corrected me on this.
So one of the things you said was that incarceration doesn't work and the anti-drug messages that we do don't work. That's not true. Things didn't work. We wouldn't continue them in general. Like incarceration really works well for a large or substantial minority of our society. There are people who benefit, law enforcement, their budgets are increased, politicians benefit, people who write stories in the media, even they benefit, documentary filmmakers, they all benefit from these sort of myths about drugs. Because when you watch a film about drugs, most often they just get it completely wrong. But we don't think, or we don't really talk about the documentary filmmakers. We don't talk about the filmmakers. But we do go after law enforcement, and as well we should. But all of these people are benefiting handsomely. It's just that the American taxpayers are not. And then those poor people who get caught up in prison, of course, they're not benefiting. But please make no mistake about it. Incarceration is working. That's why it continues. And then when we think about the anti-drug sort of messages in these campaigns, they too work. They work for parents. Parents don't have to learn anything about drugs. They don't have to learn anything about critical thinking. All they have to say is just say no, don't do this. Educators, they don't have to learn another subject. It works for them. Law enforcement with the whole DARE program, it made them feel like good guys. We're in the community educating about drugs, which we know nothing about. So we have to think about all of these things. We have to think about if a behavior is continuing, that means that it's serving some function. And mass incarceration, the behavior of engaging in mass incarceration, is serving an important function in our society. The behavior of miseducating or telling people just say no about drugs is serving as an important function in this society.
Particularly right now when you have the era of private prisons.
Yeah, like it's my instinct to go like, oh, this isn't stopping drug use, so it's not working. But I think he's absolutely right. Like, oh, it's working like gangbusters. It's just not working to stop drug use.
And it's really difficult for us as a society to continually make this claim that people shouldn't do drugs. And then when you send a kid out to go see a movie, they're doing drugs in the movie. But this guy is not up against drug dealers. This guy is up against society.
I like Dr. Hart. I like the way he talks. I like everything he's had to say. I asked Dr. Hart about something that you and I had talked about kind of before this podcast, Brandon, the fact that America only seems to finally give a shit about addiction, about addicts, now that opiates are the problem and they're killing white people.
Yes, that's not new. That's as American as apple pie, of course, right? We always do that. We have always done that for any sort of issue. And even with crack, when we had white crack users, we were a lot more compassionate than we had black crack users, for example. And we see the same thing with the opioid crisis today. But one of the things that's a little disturbing about that conversation is that outlets like the New York Times, they talk about what you just said, where we have this apparent compassion for the white people in the suburban areas, whereas with black folks, we were not as compassionate. And then we pretend to talk about racial discrimination or race in this country, and then that's it. You can't talk about race in this country and start there and stop there. This is just another tool, and it's a minor tool in terms of racial discrimination in the United States. And so it's a little frustrating for me to have that conversation when there are so many conversations to have about drugs. You need to have bigger conversations about racial discrimination. Because if we want to talk about racial discrimination, we should really look at employment in this country. We should really look at education. We should really look at life expectancy. We should look at all of these things, which are far bigger issues and far more important issues than how we are being compassionate toward white suburban sort of folks who use heroin.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is we should be looking at this as a holistic issue, and rather than focusing on the substances of abuse, focusing on everything in the lives of these people in these communities. Like, it's not just a question of what drugs are these people using and where are they using them, but it's a question of what is their employment like, what sort of life opportunities do people have, what sort of discrimination do they face in their day-to-day life, because that all plays into the larger issue.
Yes, I just don't want to get trapped into talking about the simple narrative. We are more compassionate towards our white brothers and sisters in West Virginia than we were with our black brothers and sisters who were in New York City.
He's right about that large issue, which is basically, if it happens to this group of people, then it will certainly happen to this group of people, and that it's a lifestyle thing before it even becomes a racial thing.
Yeah, and it's also, it's easy to make that simple observation of, oh, we suddenly care about addicts now that they're white, and then leave it there, rather than talking about like, what does that actually mean? What does that mean in terms of how, like, what do we, what's the next step other than just being like, look, I noticed a thing. When he talks about like how the documentary filmmakers benefit, it's way too easy to just be like, I see thing, I see bad thing. Like, give me praise for noticing that this is a little weird, but I'm still not going to address the root of the problem.
Yeah, we call it abolition porn or suffer porn.
Yeah. One of the things I really enjoyed about my talk with Dr. Hart is that he is the furthest thing in the world from an abolitionist when it comes to this. Like, he is a... Well, I'll just let him talk about sort of his journey into drug addiction treatment and where he is now.
So I got into this business thinking that I was going to solve people's problem with drug addiction, and I wanted to make my contribution just like many people want to make a contribution. I thought I was going to solve that problem of drug addiction. And the thing that helped me really see it is when I started to come up against numbers like, most of the people who use drugs don't have a problem. Wait, what? Most of the people who use crack cocaine don't have a problem? Yep, that's true. Most of the people who use heroin don't have a problem. Then I start to think about people who I knew who used those drugs and so forth. And it's like, oh, wow, that's true. And this person uses that. So that kind of banged up against what I was thinking about drugs. That was one of the things that helped me to see this better. Another thing that helped me to see this better is that, you know, I teach in prison too, and I've known people in prison and those sorts of things. And then you see people who are there because of drug-related sort of charges. And then you see that, wait a second, they don't have a drug problem. It's clear they don't have a drug problem. I mean, drugs are there in prisons, but certainly not plentiful. And most of the people are not using drugs, even the ones who were supposedly there for drugs. So it's like, it's not the drug that's the problem. And then it just got me to start thinking about our society in a more critical way or just a more thoughtful manner. And so all of these things helped me to start thinking about it differently. And then, of course, my own drug use. I used heroin. I used all of these drugs. Never had a problem. And always was responsible. So it's like, was I special? I mean, it's easy to think about yourself as being special, but really I'm not, and most of us are not. And so, well, what's going on? So all of the reality started to bang up against what was being said. And so we have to try and get people to think about drugs from even their own perspective, if they can think about it more critically.
It also strikes me, because something you brought up in your email is you didn't want to purely talk about addiction. So I think I'll move us into a different sort of realm of topic around drugs, which is the increasing body of research and science into the way these things can have very positive societal impacts. Personally, I think the one that is easiest for me to talk about and to get people to maybe change their minds on is talking to my very conservative, very anti-drug relatives about the studies that are being done with MDMA and combat veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, because I think they're naturally more sympathetic towards, you know, young men who went to war, because that's the easiest way I have of getting people to consider the possibility that maybe some of our rules about which drugs are legal and illegal are not based in solid evidence as much as they are in paranoia. And I'm curious as to, I don't know, what you think about sort of talking about the research being done into some of these chemicals and the helpful effects of some of these chemicals as a way to reduce the stigma and maybe alter people's minds about, you know, how to deal with drugs on a societal level.
Yeah, that's certainly, like you point out, some people are more likely to be compassionate when they see a war veteran, for example, who has PTSD. And you give something like MDMA and they have, it helps them with that sort of thing, because clearly these are not undeserving people. And that's been helpful to change the perspective of some people. One of the things that's a little troubling about that situation is that it denies the fact that there are people like me, for example, who may want to use MDMA with my significant other and enhance our interactions or in an evening or something, or other people who may want to use cocaine to enhance their social interaction at a party or something or a reception. So that perspective denies that at some level, and that's a little troubling to me. But I am encouraged that we have the ability to have a multi-pronged approach, and that if it makes those people who feel like, well, these people are not undeserving, they are deserving, they went to war, so we can understand why they would use MDMA. So if you have that moralistic perspective, okay, fine. but it troubles me.
Man, I'm just trying to use a little bit of cocaine at this reception.
No, that's, I love how he's really emphatic about being open about the fact that, like, no, this isn't just about I think these drugs have a medical use. It's also I don't see why I shouldn't be able to have, like, anyone who lives long enough, you know, people who've been jackasses on cocaine at parties.
Yes.
But, like, I know people who have done way worse when drunk. Nobody on coke's ever puked inside my car.
Right. I do love how smooth he got when he was talking about his own personal use. And he was like, I might want to use a little MDMA with my significant other.
To enhance our interactions.
I could hear a little Miles Davis getting queued up right when he said it. I was like, okay, smooth Yvonne, smooth.
And why the hell, no one who's taken MDMA can honestly tell me the world wouldn't be a better place if more people every now and then had a nice night with their significant other and just rolling a little bit.
At a reception at a wedding reception or in the reception, the lobby reception.
Fucking licking the walls.
Telling the bride, you're so happy for her. Isn't love a great thing? You guys are so lucky.
I'm lucky too because my hands feel fucking amazing right now.
You should have seen that cake I just took a bite of. It was so amazing. It had people on top of it who looked just like you.
I think if we had MDMA weddings, though, there wouldn't be a cake. It would just be a pile of pacifiers.
Yeah, and it would take like 7 hours, but you wouldn't care.
No, it'd be a great time. Everybody'd be happy as hell. I do a lot of these articles where we talk about like the medicinal use of various illegal narcotics, and that's obviously more important than me having fun with them. But it's also important that we advocate, like, I think I have the right to have fun on drugs. I think that's my human right.
It puts the farm in pharmacology. We've always grown stuff to make ourselves feel better. And when we come across a plant or a chemical that can help us get through this galaxy on this spinning rock, we should be allowed to dabble. Because we know that some of the greatest ideas in our culture have come from people who were under the influence at the time.
Yeah, and also Doc Ellis's no-hitter, which was,
That's really the benchmark, ladies and gentlemen.
When you can be the best player on the field despite not knowing what day it was when you woke up, that's...
They also said that MDMA was used by Merck Pharmaceutical back in the day to bring couples together. So if there's something that can help you stop fighting with a person that you live with 24/7, that's a powerful and useful drug.
But I get that, you know, some people are only willing to accept or start accepting, you know, that we should loosen our restrictions on some of these drugs when they see, a war hero using it to treat their PTSD. That may be kind of a silly standard to hold a substance to. But if it helps, it helps. And I think it helps MDMA because ecstasy still has this reputation from the late 90s and the early 2000s as this club drug that eats holes in kids' brains. And I think a sizable number of people are more willing to open their minds up when they hear something's good for the troops. So here's a troops.
I'm Tony Macy. I joined the Army out of high school in 2005. I deployed to Iraq in 2006, 2007 for... almost 15 months.
Tony did 2 tours in Iraq, and spoiler alert, it gave him PTSD. We're going to get to that story, but first we've got to say some lovely words about our sponsors. So, after the break, we'll talk about Tony's PTSD and how his life was changed by taking part in a legal MDMA study. Hey guys, do y'all, this is Robert, by the way, from the thing you're listening to. Do y'all love Game of Thrones with the knives and the ghosts and the dragons and the ghost dragon? Ah, shit, that's a spoiler. Well, probably not. I mean, you all have access to the internet, and everybody watches Game of Thrones, so just deal with it, I guess. What's important here is that Stitcher has an opportunity for you to get a deep dive into your favorite epic fantasy world with audio from the largest ever convention for GOT fans, which I don't think... What are we, Thronesers? Game heads? Uvians? I don't know. Anyway, Stitcher Premium has 16 sessions from Con of Thrones on their little podcast recording thingamajigger, so you can listen to interviews with talent from the show and expert discussions touching on topics like race, gender, and whether or not it was spoiling to say the thing about the ghost dragon. It's a must-listen for all Game of Thrones fans. Unless you're not cut up on the show, in which case even what I've said so far is probably bumming you out. Either way, go to stitcherpremium.com/conofthrones and use the promo code CRACKED at checkout to get your free month. And we're back. Let's hear from Tony, our vet with PTSD.
I have a couple of moments in my mind that stick out. One was when our patrol base was hit by a dump truck full of explosives. And I was the first responder back there, so we were calling it medevacs. This is my troop that I'd worked with for 6 months, I think, at this point. We'd been deployed together. So seeing all of them injured, and two of them end up being KIA, two interpreters ended up being KIA. So four people went from an hour before we were leaving saying goodbye at the patrol base, and then a couple hours later, it's, you have a whole platoon who's almost down. So that was pretty hard. And then later that day, they told us that we were extended another 3 months, so I don't think he'd crush morale anymore. And then towards the end of my deployment, I worked in the squadron TOC as fire support.
TOC stands for Tactical Operations Center. It's like a mission control where officers provide tactical support for troops on the ground, that sort of thing.
And being on the ground, it was a lot easier mentally because I had control over it. When I got moved to the TOC, I thought life would be better. It was, because I wasn't personally as much in danger towards the end of my deployment going out on patrols, but it was worse in the sense that I couldn't be there in control situations too. And there's an event where one of my buddies called in because his guy and his troop stepped on a IED and it killed him. And I had to choose whether or not to send the medevac to him, where the person who was already KIA, or divert the medevac to another person who was wounded and tell them to carry their body, the body back to the patrol base. And, you know, that never really sat too well with me, because I know by telling them to carry the body back, I scarred them for life.
So you would have thought that his life had gotten much easier because he's no longer on the ground. But as it turns out, dude, it's just as difficult.
Yeah, this is something I actually brought up on that Harmontown podcast we did. But they've done studies that show that, like, the most stressful thing for soldiers in general is being in situations where they don't have direct control. They did some studies on, like, pilots. And there's one particular study that they did with a special forces base in, like, the middle of Laos in the 70s where they warned everyone that there was going to be a giant attack on the base where they would be horribly outnumbered by all of these North Vietnamese soldiers. And it was a lie. They were just doing it to test people's stress reactions, which is kind of crazy, but that's what they did. And they noticed that in the weeks leading up to the supposed, or in the days leading up to the supposed attack, the stress chemicals in the brains of the officers skyrocketed, and the actual soldiers themselves had almost no stress. And then when the attack didn't come, the stress in the officers dropped and the stress among the soldiers skyrocketed because suddenly they felt out of control. They didn't know what was going to happen now. Before, they were like, oh, we're just going to have to fight. We know how to fight. You know, it's not my job to plan our reaction to this. It's just my job to shoot at people, and I'm good at that. And then when that didn't happen, that's what made them start to go crazy, because then they were in the unknown. And it's feeling like you have a lack of control that is in some ways one of the most traumatizing things that can happen to you.
Like when a police car gets behind you. And you think, what's next?
It's up to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's one of the things I think that you talk to survivors of sexual assault. They talk about how a lot of the healing process is getting back some sort of sense of control because that's been taken from you. So in general, when you're talking about like the things that give PTSD to people, that lack of control is almost more of a factor than just seeing something terrible.
It also seems like PTSD sort of brings out other control issues that you may or may not have had. So if you lose a loved one, if you're going through some sort of grief, you're like, things that didn't bother me before suddenly bother me. Like, if before going to Iraq, you were cool about sitting in this section at a restaurant, the fact that you can't pick out your section closest to the buffet is now a huge deal versus what it used to be.
It's interesting, and one of the things that's really interesting about this is that it's entirely possible that the U.S. military today suffers PTSD at a higher rate than any other military in history. PTSD diagnoses among deployed soldiers rose 400% from 2004 to 2012. 30% of American soldiers who see war walk away with PTSD, which, you know, compared to 4% of British soldiers in the same conditions. So obviously some of that increase is due to the fact that we're better at diagnosing PTSD, but there's a huge disparity between how traumatized our soldiers are versus, you know, soldiers of our closest ally, because Brits are basically Americans with funny accents. And considering how many American soldiers walk away from their war experiences with PTSD, you might expect the VA to have gotten pretty good at dealing with it by now, but they're actually really, really bad at it. Back in 2007, the National Academies published a study that essentially said, hey, there's no actual evidence that anything we do to treat PTSD actually works. The one treatment they said seemed to help was called exposure therapy, and it boils down to making patients reimagine their traumatic events repeatedly until the events lose their potency. According to Tony, that's still the VA's go-to treatment, and he thinks it actually makes the problem a hell of a lot worse.
4 or 5 months ago, I had to go back to the VA and do evaluations and talk to them, and my mindset was okay before I went there, and then after talking to them, they made things worse. I don't know why they need to bring up trauma and have me experience or want to talk about the past things when they've recorded it 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times. And then every single doctor I see has to ask me, have I witnessed someone who's died in front of me? How did I feel? I think they're sick in the head with the way they approach things. And I can absolutely understand why people who are in a vulnerable state break when they go and see them. I was actually pretty taken back when I went home recently to do that, how much it actually affected me and triggered things again. I wish I had something better to say, but the VA originally, when you go in there, they have you fill out a form. Some of the questions on there trigger memories. For me, I'm stable, but I could see if someone was having a panic attack and they were going through it and they're going down a questionnaire where it's, hey, is your panic at 0 to 5? Did you witness someone die? Like, these things are going to trigger and make it worse. And then when you go in and you see the doctor, they record it in the computer, but the doctor's going to want to hear it from you, and then he's going to ask you the questions. And then he's going to send you to the doctor who can prescribe, and then that doctor who's going to prescribe is going to ask you the same questions again. So when you go in, you're going to see 3 people, and you're going to get asked the same questions 3 times in a row. And then if you want to go back 2 weeks later, 6 months later, even if you went back 2 days later, you'll have the same thing happen.
So yeah, it turns out that exposure therapy is kind of garbage. It helps some people, but the data shows that more than half of vets drop out of therapy because it's too traumatic, and a significant number of them see their symptoms worsen after being forced to relive their trauma dozens and dozens and dozens of times. Which, like, why would you ever think that would help? Just like,
I think sometimes that the details are what you get stuck on when things happen that are bad, and you will take them out and put them into too much of a context. Like, you get picked on in high school and then you think 30 kids picked on you. But if we actually talk about it and we remember it as clearly as we possibly can, it was more like 5 kids. So I can see where they're trying to go with it. It just seems like talking to people about what they need is the first step, not just making people talk about what they have seen.
Yeah, it's the difference between, like, I think it's, of course it's valuable to talk about, like, stuff you've seen that you're still going through in your head and working with. But, like, when you have a friend or a family member come to you and talk about something difficult, you don't just ask them the same questions about it 6 times in a row. Usually it's, like, 90 to 100 times is the actual, like, VA sessions. Like, they're just asking the same, tell me again about seeing this guy turn into pink mist. And it's, like, past a certain point, you're not helping.
Yeah, it's crazy because what they tell you in other types of treatment is when they ask you about yourself and you're like, this is me, this is what happened to me. They go, well, that was your story, and now we're going to rewrite your story. Whereas in this therapy, it sounds like they're really solidifying that story in your mind.
Yeah, and I think that's what the data shows it does, is it solidifies the problems in these guys' heads, because it was one of those things back when they first realized that none of their other treatments were working. This was something they had a little bit of data that suggested it might help, so they just went whole fucking hog in on exposure therapy. And for years, that was the go-to treatment, and it still is, but it doesn't. There's just no evidence that it actually helps most people. And the other standard VA treatment for PTSD involves shoveling big, meaty handfuls of antipsychotics into people's mouths.
It's hard for me to remember because, I mean, at that point in my life, I was taking so many oxycodone, so many pharmaceuticals. It was the word, what's the popular trending word, zombie, dope, or whatever now. Like, I literally don't really remember that part of my life. I just remember not wanting to get out of bed, having complete lack of motivation, and just really bad habits. I mean, the habits of taking the medication, not taking care of myself, not holding myself responsible, always looking, oh, next week I'll do it, next week I'll do it, next week I'll do it. Detaching from family, friends, not really having any interest, but taking my pills, and that's about it. it's a pretty sad life.
And sure enough, in 2011, the AMA published a study that revealed the most commonly prescribed of these drugs, risperidone, is no more effective at treating PTSD than a placebo. So that's where we are right now, and where Tony found himself in 2011 when he learned that a doctor named Michael Mithofer was carrying out the first legal studies on MDMA treatment for PTSD.
At that point in my life, I was living in South Carolina, going to school at Clemson, studying pre-med. I believe I was doing research on alternative treatments and came across MDMA and psilocybin and these other things happening. And then the MAPS trial came up, being in Charleston. So I kind of did the online researching through medical articles a little bit more and saw that it was the pre-1985. They actually benefited a lot of couples, and it was this medicine that didn't have like an antidepressant in everyday use. It was you take once, twice, three times, spread out over a month, 6 months, whatever it is, and you see lasting results. So that's what kind of really intrigued me. And then after I reached out to them, we talked. They did assessments on PTSD, other psychological things, heart, full physical, and I was healthy enough and fit the parameters for their research with treatment-resistant PTSD, and that's how I got into the study.
I don't want to portray MDMA as some magical silver bullet for PTSD, but that is kind of how it sounds in Tony's recollection.
To this day, I get a big grin when I think about it. The first hour, I was laying down on, it's like a futon couch they have, and both Dr. Mithofer sits on one side, and his wife, nurse, Ann sits on the other side. And you have eye shades on, headphones where you're listening to just music to kind of induce the mood up and down to get you into the process. And beforehand, they taught me breathing exercises and kind of went over what we could expect. And also that when it kicks in, right before, you usually do feel a lot of anxiety. Some people do. And for me, I did, because I believe, you know, I was very hypervigilant, so I'm noticing these changes start to occur to my surroundings, and I'm thinking, okay, what the hell did I just do? What did I sign up for? What did they give me? Is this even MDMA?
It was that dramatic of an experience, and it was just being able to, like, feel like he trusted them so that he could talk with them about something rather than just having to answer these questions over and over again, being able to, like, relax enough to have an honest conversation about what was happening in his head. I've heard psychiatrists describe the potential of some of these drugs for their field as like the psychiatry equivalent of a telescope or a microscope.
Yeah.
Because it gives you the ability to analyze things that you just can't analyze without them.
Because people are inhibited. Mm-hmm. And then once you get them into their actual id and they cannot throw up walls because they physically cannot throw up walls, I think maybe you get a clearer picture of who they are. It's crazy because you're just like, all I needed was one chance to feel good. Mm-hmm. And then I could reset my brain if you just got me to a place where, oh, I remember this feeling of what it feels like to have hope, of what it feels like, even if it's not even based in truth. You just wanted something that made you be like, oh, that's right. I can feel this good. I completely forgot that I can feel this good, even on my own.
Yeah, you just need the cloud cover to lift for like a fucking second.
Just a second.
And that's what I think people, I don't know, have you ever taken ecstasy, Brandon?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a great party drug, obviously. It's a great thing to take if you're going to go dancing all night. But it's like what the drug does on its own, if you're not taking a massive dose that's been adulterated with a bunch of stuff, is you just can't be anxious or afraid. You just feel optimistic and happy. And it's kind of impossible to overstate how huge that is when it comes to letting people think about their minds and their lives.
The craziest thing is when I did use, I found myself feeling the same emotion that I'd had when I was about 8 years old. And then even on that journey, I could feel memories coming back to being happy without drugs. So what it really kept chanting to me was, oh, I know this feeling. I can get this feeling. I never felt like when I took ecstasy, oh man, I want more. I need to do more. It's quite the opposite. You'll notice amongst some ecstasy users, they'll take it and then they won't take it again for like another 5-6 years, or they'll take it for a month, use it, play with it, and then they're good for the rest of their lives, because unlike other drugs, this drug speaks to you in a way that says, hey, you can get here by yourself. You just needed to remember that this place existed.
Yeah, that your brain is capable of being here. Tony had his trip alongside Dr. Mithover and his wife, Anne Mithover, who is a nurse. They were talking to him, asking him questions, and basically trip-sitting him the entire time.
And I went from this hypervigilant anxiety state to this relaxed, clear, blissful state of just, I think, deeper subconscious understanding. I don't know. It wasn't that I was high. I was just very relaxed. For the first time in a long time, the anxiety was absolutely not there. My thought process, though, unlike when I'm taking the pharmaceuticals, the painkillers or Xanax or other things, my thought process was clear. And from there, I just started for an hour to relax because my back hurt. That's why I got painkillers in the first place, was from a back injury. And my body was just kind of like vibrating, just pulsing, felt amazing, and I was relaxed. So the first hour, I just had my eyes shut and enjoyed it. And then memories, things started coming up. Oh, this is what's going on in your life. You're taking that out on your family, because just all these thought processes started coming up, and I saw how they were combined, and I saw the patterns that I created from combat where I needed to react quickly. We're not suitable for back in society, and I don't need them anymore. And I was having lessons come up about myself that I already knew. It was just I was suppressing and I didn't really want to face. But with the lack of fear and no anxiety, it was easy to go into. And the things with the deployment about, I always wished I could do this to prevent that patrol base attack. I was like, I'd fantasize about, oh, if I would only have been there and I could have done this, I could have stopped it. I had unrealistic things that kept me up at night. So my sweeping, I would stay up at night trying to think about, oh, if I could have done this, then that would have never happened. And I wasn't accepting that it happened and moving on with my life. That was the biggest thing that hit me, was it happened. I needed to accept it. And what can I do now and in the future with my life to be productive, to honor them, to honor myself? And it was just very profound.
So yeah, Tony wasn't magically cured, but MDMA therapy was the catalyst that helped him get control of his life and his emotions again.
It was profound for me with the amount of insight I got into myself. And I've never experienced that with medications and therapy alternatively. It certainly gave me a window of time to be comfortable and look objectively at my life and how I was living my life, and also come up with solutions to how to change it. And after the session, it was up to me whether or not I wanted to do it or not. And I just had a different outlook because I was able to understand myself, the things that I was doing. And once I was able to understand, I could stop that and change the habits and kind of focus on exercising or getting into something that I enjoy, being part of something bigger than just myself, which I liked in the military. So when I got out, I felt this missing piece of, where's my brotherhood? Where's my big purpose? What can I be doing with my time? And then the medication was just a way to drown that out. So I guess for me, it was just everything that I was suppressing, I was able to face.
Today, Tony lives in Cambodia, and he's founded a charitable organization called Expert Exchange. It basically helps by hooking veterans with skills up with communities where those skills are needed. It's Tony's way of kind of finding that brotherhood again and feeling like he's a part of something bigger. You can find him and his charity at expert-exchange.org.
Yeah, so drugs led him to an awful, awful situation where now he's just roaming Cambodia helping people out. It's crazy how that happens.
Yeah, that would be a great anti-drug ad. Yeah. Just like a guy walking through a field in Cambodia helping like a kid with his cleft palate. Right. Not even once. MDMA.
They should do, Home Depot should link up with cocaine and be like, look at all the stuff you can do this weekend with cocaine and Home Depot.
The day's twice as long when you don't sleep. Home get Depot in, brand blow.
Get in for our early bird savings at 2 a.m. we start.
Every 2x4 comes with a line.
None of this wood is straight, but you don't care about that. You'll straighten it enough when you get home. Get 14 rolls of sandpaper, because let's be honest, you love to sand cocaine and Home Depot.
What a winning combination.
I've done it. When you do carpentry on drugs, it's the most amazing
thing. Oh, man, I built a table while fucked up on Kratom, and it was great, man. And it was just a lot of sanding and then putting on the stain and sanding and putting on the stain. It's a great table.
You put on the stain when you're all fucked up and you're doing carpentry. You put the stain on like a person who's bowling, because you're like, you'll take a stroke and then you'll walk away from it and just be so proud of yourself.
This was not a planned part of the podcast, but I do think it's important to talk about all of the hobby benefits of being high as tits.
No cut days, though. Don't cut those days. Just stain and sand.
So in MDMA therapy is pretty powerful, but it's also like actual therapy. You've got a medical professional there treating you. No experts are suggesting we treat PTSD by just handing out E to everyone who wants it. That said, there's at least one case of a currently illegal drug that seems to have a profoundly positive medical benefit by just being legalized. In 2016, right after legalizing marijuana, Colorado saw their overdose deaths drop by 27%. Now, there's been a lot of pushback on the idea that this is due to legal weed. One thing that the counterside will point out is that we happen to be legalizing weed right around the same time that we were reforming our standards on when doctors hand out pain pills. And that's definitely a worthwhile point. But some of the doctors who are hesitant about this just sound kind of ridiculous. I'm going to read this quote from a 2014 Newsweek article. In states with medical marijuana, painkiller deaths drop by 25%. Not so fast, said Dr. Andrew Kolodny, chief medical officer at Phoenix House, a national nonprofit addiction treatment agency. He said that the immediate reduction in overdose deaths is extremely unlikely to be due to the substitute use of the herb, for one simple reason. Marijuana isn't widely prescribed for chronic pain. You don't have primary care doctors in these states prescribing marijuana instead of Vicodin, he said. Even in states where medical marijuana is legal, it is only prescribed by a small subset of doctors, and therefore probably couldn't explain the huge decrease in opiate-related deaths. Now, to me, that's fucking adorable, because clearly this guy seems to think that most people with chronic pain go to the doctor for it, that people who can buy pot from a store when they're hurting would be like, but a doctor's not giving it to me, so I'm gonna... That's a silly thing to assume to me. It's like, well, most doctors aren't prescribing it, so clearly people aren't using this to treat their pain. It's like, motherfucker, there's people in every state in the country using pot for pain right now.
Yeah, that's the first wave of people being able to buy medical marijuana was people who were in pain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's crazy. But nice. You know what, Narc? You don't know anything about our drugs. Get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, like, if you've got no other option, you suck up the expense and you go to a doctor to treat your chronic pain. But if you can go to, like, a fake pot doctor for $50 and get your pot card and just, you do that.
Also,
health insurance is expensive.
There's multiple types of pain. If you have a psychological pain, if there's a trauma, you're not going to be able to get prescribed a painkiller for your psychological trauma. Marijuana is a painkiller for your psychological trauma.
Yeah, I have friends who are young people who are prescribed opiate painkillers, and it's a pain in the butt to fill that prescription because you often get it delayed or denied, even if you have the prescription, because they're like, they see a young person trying to fill a Vicodin prescription, and they're like, oh, this seems sketchy to me. And so I know people who have just stopped going to their pain doctor because pot works pretty well for them and it's easier. Nobody ever says you can't buy this pot at the pot store. Like, they don't care why you want the pot at the pot store.
Right.
Yeah. I have a friend with chronic leg pain because he got shot in the leg. And when he went to get his pot prescription, he just got onto Skype along with a guy who wanted it for anxiety. And they both Skyped the doctor. And the doctor wasn't there. So the nurse just signed their things for them, because that's how pot prescriptions work in California.
True. And it's the craziest thing. You try to get your card and they ask you a bunch of questions and you want to look at them and say, like, stop, man. Don't. Let's be honest. We know you did something. What'd you do? Kill a kid?
Yeah.
You kill a kid? That's why you're a pot doctor right now? Yeah. Is somebody got a sponge in them? Is that why you're a pot doctor right now? Let's be real honest with each other. We're both here for the same thing.
I have to assume all those doctors are either like 50% shitty doctors and 50% great doctors who got into like oncology and are just like, I don't want to deal with dying people anymore. I've had too many dying people.
Yeah, it's hand over fist, the money.
Yeah.
Because the cost to get your medical marijuana license is worth going into business, quite honestly. You know, every time I pass by one of those places, shall we say, there's at least 8 people in the room, and at $50 to $60 a pop, it's kind of crazy, and it's amazing how doctors manage to get the line. I'm like, it's incredible that doctors were able to be like, whoa, 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 you got to pay us if there's drugs coming out of someplace. Think you know the deal here?
Yeah, we're subsidizing medical school and getting people high at the same time. I love the guy on Venice who is the only pod doctor I've gone to who always has that white lab coat and he always has a stethoscope on. But there's like right outside of his waiting room, there's a framed picture of the Mona Lisa with a blunt in her hands. It's like, yeah, this feels like a real doctor's office to me.
Yeah. They should have a moving scale that says you have to be this tall to get into this office. And then if you're 5'6", it goes up. And if you're 5'9", it goes up. It's a revolving door of many, many people using all sorts of reasons without any sort of evaluation. Thank God.
But it's fine because it's pot.
Right.
Like, it's one of those things. There's plenty of articles about how the number of pot-related hospitalizations have leapt in states that legalize it. But also, none of those people die. Right. And the number of overdoses always falls.
And the cure is stop smoking pot, and it's a non-addictive substance.
Yeah. I mean, it's as psychologically addictive as, you know, your favorite television show.
Right.
Like, nobody's drowning in their own vomit because they got a little bit too high.
But there are a ton of people out there willing to suck your dick for House of Cards.
Yeah.
So it's a slippery slope.
Is that how they produced that show? I always wondered what they paid what's-his-name.
It comes from Junkie Blood.
Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, it comes from TV Junkie Blood. Two Broke Girls, same thing, man. You can get an uncut episode of Two Broke Girls on any street in America.
To me, the strongest evidence that we've seen that actually supports the more pot, fewer overdoses conclusion is that this pattern, about a 25% decrease in overdose fatalities, has held true across 23 states so far. In an earlier podcast, we talked to Peter Grinspoon. He's a doctor, a former opiate addict, and a huge advocate of medical marijuana for reducing prescription opiate use and abuse. Here is Peter again.
Generally speaking, I think that we have very few treatments for chronic pain. And, you know, as Americans get older and more arthritic and develop more medical conditions, it seems like inevitably they develop one sort of chronic pain or another. And our options are opiates, which are very inefficient for chronic pain and dangerous. We have Tylenol, which doesn't do very much at all. We have non-steroidals like ibuprofen and naproxen, which are very dangerous for your gastrointestinal tract and your kidneys. And then we have marijuana, which is in many ways the safest option of all.
So yeah, this seems like one situation where having a drug just available to whoever wants it whenever they want it might work better than anything else.
And as we know, the more people that are exposed to opiates, the more people become dependent on them. And unfortunately, the more people become addicted, abuse them, and the more pills are available, become abused, stolen, or diverted by other people. So on a whole variety of levels, the increasing use of medical marijuana to treat chronic pain is going to help prevent people from becoming addicted to opiates in the first place.
Part of me wonders how much of all this is due just to doctors being really expensive. Like, it's way easier to go to a pot doctor or a pot shop than to pay out the nose for actual medical care. And, you know, if actual medical care often winds up getting you prescribed these drugs that you then develop an addiction to and start buying off the street and then eventually trade into heroin, is it possible that just it's saving lives because people don't go to the doctor for pain as often when pot is legal? I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say yes, that's what's happening. I don't know. I was waiting for someone to push back against my ideas, but it didn't come, so.
Yeah, they're going to a pot doctor just to save their own lives instead of finding some dude who could get them on something that they could not potentially get off of,
mm-hmm.
which is a huge concern. People are like, I don't want to take something that's harder to get off on than it was to feel bad.
And I should note that Peter's not advocating the willy-nilly use of marijuana, which I am. Peter is a doctor, and he's talking from his professional experience, and he urges caution. But he's also pointing out, I don't know, some things I think people should be aware of.
Furthermore, it's been shown that people who are using opiates are able to lower their dose when they start using medical marijuana. And we know that a lot of the overdoses and other problems with opiates are dose-related. So if we can continue to use medical marijuana to lower the dose of opiates, we make the opiate use much safer. And then finally, people are increasingly having success transitioning off opiates using marijuana. And if that's the case, that would be much safer because no one has ever overdosed on marijuana versus the dozens of people a day that are dying of overdoses from opiates. opiates in this country, not to mention the many, many more people that are overdosing that are dying but are leaving a trail of wreckage in their path. So on a whole variety of levels, it's much safer to use marijuana than it is to use opium.
Take that, gateway drugs.
Yeah, it's the opposite of a gateway drug. It's a sphincter drug.
Yeah.
It closes out the other drugs.
It's also crazy because nobody was like, are you using less opiates because you have marijuana now and the two combined is too strong for you? Like, are you less likely to drink a six-pack if you know you have a joint?
Now, that's a really good question because I do, you know, there I think there's a period of time in everybody else's, in everyone's life who likes drugs when being crunk is the shit. But there's also, I don't know, I get the spins now when I get drunk and stoned at the same time. It used to be fun. Now I pick one or the other. Am I going to drink tonight or am I going to get high?
I do the order. That's the thing that everybody knows. You got to smoke and then drink. Don't drink and then smoke or it's over. It actually does something to the receptors too, is that once you've had a bunch of alcohol, you absorb marijuana a lot differently than you would. And the reverse is not necessarily true.
That's interesting.
You can smoke pot and still get a little buzzed on alcohol.
Weed before liquor, then put on the clicker.
Weed before liquor makes the buzz thicker.
Oh, shit. Oh, that's good. Okay. And then liquor before beer, but after weed, and you should wear tweed. Yo, I don't know. That one didn't play out in my head. Because, like, nerds wear tweed. That was what I was going for.
I mean, distinguished nerds.
Yeah. So during our interview, Peter actually dropped some new-to-me science on my lap. I wasn't aware of it, but there's an actual chemical explanation for why pot works better for some chronic pain than opiates.
In acute pain, if you break your leg, you need an opiate. And other medications like Advil, Naperson, Aleve, they aren't strong enough. And medical marijuana is good for mild to moderate pain. It's not strong enough for severe pain. So for an acute issue, like a broken bone or a surgery, you certainly need opiates. But there's very little data that they're effective for chronic pain.
Yeah, he's basically saying that there's actually no evidence that opiates are good for long-term pain. If you break your arm, it's the best thing in the world. If you've got a disc herniation, it actually might make the pain worse because essentially it makes your nerves more sensitive when you come off it, so you feel like you're in more pain, so you take more opiates. Which, when it comes to treating chronic pain, marijuana does not do that, doesn't sensitize you. So there's a strong argument to be made that by prescribing opiates for any kind of chronic pain, all we do is make the chronic pain worse and also give people an opiate addiction. So yeah, we've got a lot of evidence that supports using currently illegal drugs to help solve or mitigate some of the greatest ills of our era. I haven't even gotten into how well LSD works as a treatment for alcoholism or the research on psilocybin on death anxiety among the terminally ill. At a certain point, it's not useful to just keep throwing down data because for every incredibly thorough, peer-reviewed scientific study you cite, someone on the Jeff Sessions side of the fence has an anecdote about how deadly these drugs are. I brought that up to Carl Hart.
Even beyond the studies, it's so easy when you say, well, look at these numbers, you know, the numbers paint a very different picture of this problem than you're saying. Well, they'll come back with a, well, here's an anecdotal story about somebody I know or about somebody I heard about. That's tough to argue with, especially if the other person is very eloquent.
No, you make an excellent point. Now, I agree completely with the anecdote. That's what's driving policy, the anecdotes. People come and they tell you about a neighbor or a relative who overdosed on heroin after the first time they used it. Or they tell you some incredible story. But that's where we have to get more skilled at helping people understand the difference between anecdote and evidence and how we have this thing, ways of knowing. There are multiple ways of knowing. You have religion, you have all of these things. You have anecdote, you have science. And so it's like we have to, in the conversations, we have to say, okay, which of these ways of knowing are we going to give higher credence to? And so you have to disarm people with the anecdotes because we can just make up anecdotes. The appealing thing about anecdotes is that you have some emotional appeal or something that the listener connects with. But the problem with anecdotes is that they are oftentimes not representative of what's the general phenomena. But people who engage in conversation don't know this. And so we have to sometimes work with them to educate and help them understand the different ways of knowing and their limitations and benefits.
That's what I want. I want a dude who travels with me and says, you know what, bruh, based on your body type, based on your body fat, you get about 2 lines of this substance.
Yeah.
And then that way I'm like, well, we did coke last night, but it wasn't a life-altering risk.
Because we do have the ability to know, like, oh, based on, you know, we look through your genetics, like, alcohol would be a could be a problem right. for you. You're prone to addiction to alcohol. You're prone to addiction if you start taking painkillers. But, you know, ecstasy is going to be fine for you. You can do acid. That's good. Pot's going to be good for you. So maybe stick to those drugs and, like, actually do it with some fucking science.
Yeah, a guy who instead of making weed taste like orange suddenly makes weed that's really good for a dude with asthma, that it opens up the airways, that it treats you well.
Yeah, because it is a bronchial dilator, and it can right. be good for asthma if you're not smoking it, because right. smoking's never good for asthma.
Right.
Yeah, it's tough because the abolition attitude is like easier from a mental standpoint to get on board with, but it also ignores the fact that one of the very few things that human beings have done in every culture throughout the entire history of human civilization is drugs. And they haven't always been the same drugs. Every culture's had their own drugs. A lot of different cultures have enjoyed alcohol. But, you know, you have your cultures that it was marijuana. Like in India, it was pot.
You have yeah. people who do self-flagellation, and we know that self-flagellation yep. is going to release endorphins.
Get you high as shit.
You have people who sit in sweat lodges for 3 or 4 days, and the dehydration is what actually is the drug.
Tobacco, ayahuasca, you know, obviously alcohol, opiates. Like, there's a ton of different drugs. The Greeks had what's believed to be an LSD precursor. It was actually like LSA. They would take ergot and mix it with wine, and they would hallucinate for days on end. Socrates, like, raved about this shit. Every culture does drugs. And trying to treat the problem of drug use with just abolition is like saying, well, let's just change human beings from the way they've been in all of history in the course of like 20 years through Nancy Reagan and a couple right. of DARE ads.
Meanwhile, you got horses running around all fucked up on rotten apples.
And so, loco weed.
Right. Yeah. So it isn't just humans. Mm-mm. It seems like the idea that any sort of conscious animal has the ability to do something, catnip, mm-hmm. that takes them away for a second.
And that's not necessarily unhealthy.
Right.
It's unhealthy when it becomes the only way you can cope with the world. But, like, everybody needs something. Whether it's, and for some people, it's running. It doesn't have to be a substance. But, like, running's a drug.
Yeah.
Lifting weights is a drug.
Yep.
Fucking's a drug.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's run some more Carl.
Would it be accurate for me to say that you think it's more valuable to try to change people's minds about sort of the role of evidence and the value of evidence over anecdote than it is to augment our evidence with anecdotes that sort of argue the opposite side or try and make an emotional connection? Because I feel like if you're quoting statistics, quoting scientific studies, and the other person is bringing emotion into it, to an extent you might have to be able to bring emotion into it yourself in order to counter that.
Absolutely. What you're getting into, right, is how are we persuasive? And we started this conversation off when I was telling you, I'm trying to get better, trying to be a better artist, trying to be a better writer, trying to do all of these things so I can do just what you said. Because I need to know how to appeal to people's emotions too. But in this conversation, I've talked about my own drug use a few times. That's part of it. What you do is you disarm those folks. Like, for example, when I talk about heroin withdrawal, and I say, you know, it's like the flu. And I explain to people it's not life-threatening or any of those things. This is based on the evidence and data. And then someone will say, well, shit, you don't know. You know, you need to experience heroin withdrawal. Well, I have. And, you know, more than you. And so I may have to say this. And people oftentimes who have evidence are afraid to talk about their own drug use or their own stories. But you have to be careful in doing that, too. Because you too must understand that that's anecdote. If your anecdote is supported by evidence, great. But you can't just have anecdote alone. So it's a tricky business, and it's a one where we have to get skilled at all of these things.
It's a tricky business.
That's part of why I've tried so much to be open about my own drug use in this podcast, is that that's important. If you're going to talk about this, like, in a way, it's sort of like, I hate to keep bringing ISIS into everything. But it's why their propaganda is so effective. It's because they don't sugarcoat the death and the violence and the gore and the ugly stuff. And it's because when you talk about young people, who are the folks I think that are most at risk of developing a problem early on, the one thing that turns them off more than anything is inauthenticity.
Liars.
Yeah, liars, which is why anti-drug ads don't work. Because you know they're bullshit. Like, even if heroin's obviously dangerous, it's obviously a substance that can kill people and can cause horrible problems. But if you're lying about every drug under the sun, no one's going to believe when you say, but maybe avoid shooting drugs into your veins or something, you know, like, because if the ads were like, you can enjoy opiates a couple of times a year if you do it this way and you're this safe with, and here's the numbers to call if there's a problem, and here's the things to do if you start to find yourself addicted, that can work. But just saying pot and heroin are the same thing, don't do either of them, Nobody's going to fall for that shit.
No, we have a ton of shows on TV where people get houses and they remodel them. But let's be real honest about that. You get into a house and you could lose everything you have, and you could really destroy your future because you wouldn't be able to buy another house after losing, say, $150,000, right? Mm-hmm. On a house. That's enough debt to keep you out. But what we do with drugs is we say, oh, don't do this. When the reality is you take bigger risks on other parts of your life all day long that we encourage you to do. And then we have shows that show people getting you out of trouble. With drugs, we don't necessarily do it that way. We show intervention where we're like, see how bad this got? We don't ever say, see how bad this house got? And then they couldn't put their lives back together after they bought this house. So we definitely have to get ourselves to a position where we're like, these are the things that can help you if you should fall down. Also, how are you going to tell me not to do drugs when I saw my parents come home drunk? How are you going to tell me not to do drugs when the movies that I'm watching have people getting drunk in them? I've always wanted us to have some sort of net of education.
Yeah, and to where education on drug use isn't like the first time I learned about a heroin overdose in like a way that wasn't just, it'll kill you, was fucking right. Pulp Fiction, which is not a great place to learn about heroin.
I mean, she gets back up.
She does get back up, and it seems fine. Like, and it seems like that didn't hurt at all.
Right.
Yeah, fuck it, right into the heart.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, in science, one of the things that's not required of us, really, is to engage the public. And many of us are just comfortable publishing in our bubble and staying in the tower, even though we take money from the public for our grants. So at some level, it's nice that those scientists stay in the bubble because you don't really want them out there. But then there are others that you really want to hear from, and they are really good at it. In our science education, we're not taught even how to write for the general public. We're not taught how to speak for the general public. And in science, when we write or even speak, the first goal is not communication like people may think. The first goal is to cover your ass. And then when you're covering your ass, communication may sometimes suffer.
Yeah, it's having an awful bedside manner. It's like when you ask somebody, you ever notice when you talk to a scientist about something that actually may be good, it still sounds like they're an evil genius.
Yeah, because they're throwing out all those numbers and stuff.
Yeah.
And numbers thinking are scary.
And they're used to talking to other scientists.
Yeah.
So they're just like, well, you get this incredibly deep concept. And it sounds like it's coming from a lab, when in reality, most of scientific exploration comes out of a love for the world itself. A dude looked at a tree and was like, I wonder what's inside that tree. Not some dude who was like, if I can control trees, then I can control the planet.
And it's like that with, like, if you ever hear musicians talk about music, like, it's not fun if you don't understand how to play an instrument to hear right. musicians talk about the technical aspects of music. But because, you know, we can just listen to their music, it's fine. But science is so technical, and it's really important. Like, we need people whose whole job is to bridge that gap to the public. And part of that gap is bridged, you know, with anecdotes, with actual human stories that illustrate what the data says, but also aren't just a big data dump, because that doesn't really work for convincing people.
And since we're looking for anecdotes, I'd like to present y'all with Brendan. He's a former heroin addict we had on our last podcast, and he treated his heroin addiction with other drugs, a shitload of other drugs, and it worked.
You know, I mean, I smoked crap tons of pot when I was coming off of it, you know, aside from the stomach issues and things, just to like try to keep myself mellow. I don't know a lot of people that are, you know, a lot of people that'll be like, oh, you're on heroin, you're just rip bong hits till you can't do it anymore. But it worked for me. And, you know, having our brains are so fascinating. You know, even part of my getting clean, like about 2 days before I decided to get off of it, I took one of the most intense MDMA and ketamine trips of my life. And that also helped me put into perspective where my life had been and what the people around me were. But
now that's something I definitely want to drill into a little bit. Can you talk to me about how that MDMA and ketamine trip helped you get to a place where you realized what you needed and wanted to do vis-a-vis getting clean? Because I think that is an undertold story.
Yeah, I took 2.5 doses of MDMA, and then I split a gram of ketamine over the course of like maybe an hour or so. Dissociatives with me, like ketamine, they always open up memories. They always unlock things that I had forgotten. And this one was taking me back so far. And I realized like every one of my memories that I was having was about my dad. And like I had said, my dad had passed when I was young, which is kind of what got me into the drug use. And all these feelings, all these memories were coming back, and they were all like amazing things. Like there was one where I was probably, geez, under a year old, which is, you know, if I wasn't on drugs, I would have thought I was crazy having these memories come back to me. But it was him putting me in a car seat, and that's all it was. But it had like such a feeling of like innocence and wonderfulness. Like, I could just tell that at that time, like, the reason it was even in my brain was because of how much love that I felt at that moment. And then immediately after came just a crushing, crushing blow of sadness and anger. And then I started putting together, you know, I had gone to therapy and, you know, in my rehab sessions and things like that, like, I would always, you know, bring up, like, I understand it had something to do with my dad, but actually having the ability to have these emotions, feel these feelings that I had not thought about or had since maybe the time that they happened, and having that, like, objective look that only Molly and Kay can give you. And I was able to see just something else about these feelings that I was having and what those feelings at such a young age, and then having that the source of those feelings removed at a young age, it allowed me to see exactly what was missing from my life, exactly what was missing from my heart. And it showed me exactly, you know, objectively what I needed to do to rebuild that part of me. And even that, I didn't quite realize how important those moments were until later. And since then, I've had a couple more trips, dissociatives and hallucinogens, various things. And all of them kind of, you know, part of that too is in the early goings of my recovery, anytime I would get a really, really bad urge, instead of going out and getting dope or something, my wife would indulge me in getting some type of stimulant or tripping fucking face for a night. And those moments allowed me, or, you know, those trips, they allowed me to still get fucked up, but do it in a more productive way. And in doing so and getting fucked up, allowing me to see things, you know, look back at my past, look at my patterns, be able to look at my own self more objectively with less judgment or with more judgment, you know, in some instances. And it's just helped me keep it in perspective, helped me keep my brain in line, and at the same time has indulged my desire to still get high, you know, to still get fucked up on occasion.
And see, what I hate about the society that we live in is that that means he's not clean.
Yeah.
Is that people who would judge him in any sort of a rehab would say, oh, well, you've moved on. And it's that thing where you want to leave that is getting you so screwed up. You shouldn't want to leave. That is a ridiculous situation.
And I think one of the things that makes it tough, because I'm going to guess a lot of people started rolling their eyes when they heard that he was taking MDMA to try to get himself off of heroin. But these substances can be used to provide a sort of objectivity. It's like a telescope into the brain. And it allows people to trust a therapist that they're working with, which allows them to, you know, we're not suggesting here that if you've got a drug addiction, you go take more drugs randomly and just see what works. But I think what we are suggesting, and I think what increasing numbers of doctors are suggesting, is that we need to be studying how these substances can be used by medical professionals to help people get off of substances that are causing them problems.
Because potentially that's what pharmaceutical industries actually got right, is that we're sitting here thinking that the greatest contribution to society from them is some bullshit-ass pain medicine, mm-hmm. but we're not rewarding them when they come up with MDMA, which is what Merck Pharmaceutical came up with, like, in 1917, 1913.
It was way back in the day.
Yeah.
And it's incredible stuff. And also, you know, I want to talk about, he talks about smoking pot to help himself get through his dope sickness. And that's something that we have a huge amount of data on. I'm going to read you an excerpt from an article from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Study links medical marijuana dispensaries to reduce mortality from opiate overdoses. The analysis revealed that states with LMDs had legal medical dispensaries, had lower opioid overdose mortality rates and fewer admissions to treatment for opioid addiction than they would have had without the dispensaries. The estimated sizes of the reductions were 16 to 31% in mortality due to prescription opioid overdoses and 28 to 35% in admissions for treatments for opioid addiction.
Wow.
That's massive.
Yeah.
And again, like, you don't want to be suggesting people just start taking drugs randomly to deal with their other drug problems, but that's not part of a concerted program. These people aren't getting their pot and working with a doctor. That's just what having this other thing available allows them to do without even trying to build a system around doing that.
Right.
That's what we're seeing in reductions.
Because we're really trying to do the best we can out there to figure out, as people, how we get along on this rock. I wonder what the chocolate chip cookie survey was, as if they were missing more chocolate chip cookies.
Well, and that's the other thing, is that if we just keep legalizing pot, like, it's going to be great for RJR and Nabisco.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And popcorn sales, Cracker Jack, candy. We'll be back into our sugar addiction.
We might have a Cheeto shortage.
Right.
Yeah.
It's true, I think, that if people have an option, you got to give people options. That's what they were looking for in the first place.
Yeah. There's, like, the one-size-fits-all drug policy just does not work. I'm sure there are people who just need to never do anything.
Right.
Like, because that's just, you know, everybody's got different brains. But, you know, I think people like Brendan would say that if they hadn't had any other options besides prescription opioids, then they would have kept on doing it.
Also, this concept that all things run their course, that you may be into drugs for 10 years in your life, that you may be into heroin 10 years in your life, and that, but the time you're done with it and you want to move on and do something else, there's nothing there for you other than stigma.
And so maybe the best thing for those people, people who are going to be into a hard drug for a period of years, is to educate them so that they don't die doing it, so they can hold down a job doing it, so that their life doesn't get ruined by it, so that when they're ready to be done and move on and do something else with their lives, they have a life to move on with.
Right, because nobody wants to be penalized for a behavior or a choice that they made. Me personally, Lady Gaga, I loved her. I made a mistake. It was 5 years of my life. I was a hardcore Gaga head. Now I'm clean and sober and I'm on to T-Swift.
Get out of this room.
Cracked Gets Personal has been produced by Robert Evans, Brett Rader, and Alex Schmidt. It was engineered and edited by Brett Rader. On the next episode, we're walking a few miles in the boots of some female soldiers who spent time in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I mean, I had to be okay with sleeping in a tent full of guys. And I remember my first time out in the field with them. I just walked out of the tent one morning, all I see are just butts. They're just peeing outside the tent. And I had to be okay with that.
For Robert Evans, I'm your host, Brandon Johnson. Thank you for listening.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.